Today on Wings, Kelia Ramirez Watson interviews feminist economist Joyce Jacobson. Jacobson co-organized a campaign among economists to get Janet Yellen nominated as chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank, perhaps the world's most powerful financial position. They talk about Yellen and about the meaning of feminist economics.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Did you know that there is a field of study called feminist economics? Certain scholars, mostly women but some men too, analyze economic issues through a feminist lens. For instance, they ask if a certain governmental or business policy affects women more or differently than it does men. Exactly what the field of feminist economics encompasses is a matter of debate, even among feminist economists themselves. Many feminist economists are members of the International Association for Feminist Economics, IAFFE. The organization incorporated in 1992 and began its journal, Feminist Economics, in 1994. I joined last year. I'm Kelia Ramirez Watson, a feminist who received a bachelor's degree in economics from Fordham University in 1977. That makes this journalist a feminist economist, right? Well, yes and no, says Dr. Joyce Jacobson, IAFFE board member and Andrews Professor of Economics and Dean of Social Sciences at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. On October 26, 2013, Jacobson and I had a conversation about her background as an economist, the nature of feminist economics, and the nomination of Janet Yellen to be the first woman chair of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, the Fed, which functions as the central bank of the United States. Jacobson obtained 3 degrees from 1978 to 1988. We started the interview by talking about sexism and the lack of female faculty in economics during her student days.
You got your degrees from Harvard, the London School of Economics, and Stanford.
That's right.
That's quite a trio. Did you, during your schooling, experience any sexism yourself?
That's hard to say. You know, one doesn't always know. I don't think anything overt. There weren't many women teachers in my time, though. At Harvard, I think there were only 2 untenured women in the economics department when I was there, and neither of them got tenure. And at LSE, I didn't have any female teachers. And at Stanford, there were no women in the economics department when I got there. And that was true for the next 3 years also. And then they finally got 1 young woman assistant professor who ended up not getting tenure. It was a very male-dominated world.
To what extent do you think the lack of female professors influenced you in any way?
Well, hard to say. I mean, I think, you know, it certainly makes one used to just being around and dealing with men. I mean, there were other female students, certainly. Actually, my class at Stanford had a fairly large number of women students for the first time, really, there. So in that sense, there were other women to talk to. So I don't think it had a big effect.
And you consider yourself a labor economist? Is that right?
Yeah, I think most of my publications are mostly in what would be considered labor economics. I usually say I'm applied microeconomist.
Applied microeconomist.
Right.
Not one of my favorite subjects, actually.
well, microeconomics is about everything that isn't macro.
Yeah, macro was where I was. I was very much a political activist when I was in college, and so at that time, I wanted to be a legislator, and I thought a legislator should understand economics, so I majored in economics.
Oh, okay.
But for a long time now, I've not wanted to be a legislator. So, but I remember taking a graduate course as an undergraduate with the chairman of the department, and he said he respected my position that we didn't need all of this calculus in the footnotes when you were legislating.
That's,
you know,
true.
He knew I was not saying that just because I didn't like math, but because in my world of political activity and being around legislators, as I was from time to time, I knew that they weren't busy figuring out calculus.
It's sort of like when you play pool, you may not understand the physics of pool if you're a great pool player, but you wouldn't be a great pool player unless you somehow internalize them. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of the Darwinian argument about economics also, is that people who are in the game don't necessarily understand the game, but if they don't play the game correctly, they don't win. I've always thought that was maybe the more appropriate way to think about how modeling fits in.
Well, now that's a good question, though, is what is winning?
Well, state in business.
You've been to microeconomics. That's a good answer. You do have, among your recent writings, something called Closing the Gender Gap. What would it take? Mm-hmm. What would it take?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, you know, we can do these sort of calculations and think about how much, you know, more distance we have to get to make the wage gap close up, for instance, between women and men or other types of things like that. So that's sort of what that paper talks about.
I noticed some of the things you taught. You taught a course called Economics of Gender. What is that?
Well, I actually have a textbook in that area, so I use my book when I teach that course. And it looks at all the ways in which you can look at economics when you think about if there are like two agents who have gender, so that you have, instead of just the representative, you know, neutral agent, you actually have men and women. And then you can do a lot more modeling of the sort of, for instance, thinking about what goes on inside households with bargaining with people on two sides, or thinking about how to model marriage markets with people potentially on two sides. So those sorts of things then matter. And that's, then we do is a lot of time, I spend a lot of time in the book talking about things like these patterns of how women work less in the paid labor force than men, and what are the arguments for why women make less than men. And also look at, I have a comparative approach in the book where I look all around the world and see how much these patterns hold up when you move outside of the contemporary U.S. experience, both back in time and into other countries. And a lot of it, some of the more recent work is more in development economics, also about thinking about, again, how development might affect women and men differently. So there's a lot of topics in it. So basically taking any topic from a standard economics course and then thinking about, well, what if you actually think there are men and women in the model?
I noticed the computer listed it as a course for the fall of 2008, 2009. Have they just not updated that page, or has it not been offered since then?
Well, I taught it last fall when I was off last year on my sabbatical year, and I actually went out to Colorado College and I taught it there in the fall. But I haven't taught it at Wesleyan for a while, partly because I don't teach full time right now. Since I'm a dean right now, for instance, I only teach one class a year. And even before that, I was doing other kinds of administrative positions, so I wasn't teaching a full load.
So it's not a matter of the university is not interested in the economics
of
gender. Okay.
So it is a matter of, you know, electives are kind of the thing that goes, as opposed to courses you have to teach like introductory economics or econometrics.
And you also wrote another book called Queer Economics. Is there really a queer economics?
Well, it's actually a reader I put together with a student, and so it was actually kind of his senior project, and then we actually got it published. He basically went and looked for all the articles that dealt with queer issues. And again, there were articles that were very much standard labor economics, where it looked if there was a pay penalty or premium if you were gay or lesbian, for instance, and also about the issues with regarding whether you could get data on patterns by homosexuality over time. Other issues, urban enclaves, where you get certain cities that have enclaves of gay people and lesbians, all sorts of things. So again, it was trying to look at different areas of economics and think about, again, if you also thought there were gay and lesbian people, then how would things look different?
My thought, I have it in here in parentheses, straights are poor too.
Yeah, so then the question is, what else do we know? Does being gay make you better or worse off relative to the average straight person, for instance?
You consulted for the World Bank. What was that about?
I've done several projects for them. It's been on different things, mostly with the Latin American and Caribbean group. They were interested particularly in gender patterns that might disadvantage men. So I did a big study for them on thinking about how men might sometimes be worse off by virtue of being men. And there are a number of social statistics in which men look worse off than women in many countries, including, they tend to live shorter lives, but they also have higher rates of alcoholism and violence, both being victims and perpetrators of violence. So there are high in prison populations. There are a lot of indicators that show that many men don't do that well either.
it occurred to me that a lot of just everyday people in the mainstream who are not professional economists don't even know that such a thing as feminist economics exists. And so I'm going to write an article about that. And
right.
Okay, then I would like to ask you what you think feminist economics is.
That's a difficult question. I mean, I noticed a number of the questions you put in your post were about that, and asking, for instance, if you're a feminist and an economist, does that make you a feminist economist? And I think the answer is yes and no. On the one hand, you know, it does, because by definition, then you sort of are. But there is a field of endeavor in economics called feminist economics. As you've discovered, there's, for instance, the listserv for that. And there's an association, the International Association for Feminist Economics. There's a journal called Feminist Economics. And there again, it's taking the question of how might economics look different, for instance, if it had been developed by a bunch of feminists, for instance. And what kinds of topics might be covered more heavily then? How might approaches, methodological approaches, be different? I think this is still an ongoing intellectual project. I actually have a book contract right now to write a book called Advanced Introduction to Feminist Economics, which will try to explain what feminist economics is to other economists. And the way I'm going about writing that book, in part, is by looking at all the articles that have been published in the journal Feminist Economics, which is now 20 years old, and seeing what they're about. And so essentially solving inductively the problem of what is feminist economics, because I've wrestled with that for many years, of whether it is fundamentally different from standard neoclassical economics, or whether various insights that feminist economists have come up with can nonetheless be incorporated into the general paradigm.
So what would you say to a general audience, the kind of people that I report for, about what feminist economics is?
Well, I think one thing is that feminist economics is very good at saying who is affected by various policies. So it focuses on distribution more than standard economics tends to. Standard economics tends to give lip service to caring about distributional effects and equity, but ends up spending most of its time on efficiency questions. And I think feminist economists have been good about coming back around and saying, what are the actual effects on various subgroups, particularly, say, women versus men, of, say, a change in monetary policy? So it says, for any given policy, let's not pretend that everybody's affected the same, but let's think about how it actually affects groups differentially. So I think that's one large area. Another is probably thinking about the very nature of work. And Nancy Fulbright, for instance, a very influential feminist economist, has written a lot about caring labor and how caring labor is different in many ways from regular work because you develop an attachment. So say if you're taking care of a child or an elderly person, you become attached to that person and develop an emotional tie to that person also, and it changes the nature of the relationship, the work relationship of being that person's caregiver. I think that's an interesting insight that wasn't really in standard economics.
Standard economics externalizes everything that it can't quantify.
Well, and it assumes that the only benefit you get from work is that, you know, you get paid for it, and otherwise you wouldn't do it, and that work doesn't fundamentally change your preferences. So this is sort of a case where you have endogenous preferences, basically. They're changed through the nature of the work that you do. That doesn't mean we couldn't incorporate it. It just means that we don't generally have that in standard models. Certainly behavioral economists and other groups are more interested in developing models with changing preferences now also. Another line of work in feminist economics, which is an older line, it's not just in feminist economics, is thinking about how various forms of work aren't reflected in national income accounting. And particularly, again, caring labor is often not reflected because it takes place outside of the market and so isn't counted in standard national income accounting systems.
Yeah, I interviewed Selma James of the Wages for Housework. She founded that. Mm-hmm. Many, many years ago. And she is shocked that the ILO over in Europe counts soldiers as workers but does not count mothers.
Right. So there's an example of that. I mean, there are some countries that have alternative accounts where they do try to count the value of non-market work also. It turns out it's not trivial to figure out how to account that. I mean, similar to the way we don't actually do a very good job at valuation of services in paid labor, we actually don't do a good job at these types of work often because they are services also. And so it's a non-trivial technical problem of figuring out what you would actually value them at.
What's the difficulty in valuing services as opposed to goods?
Well, we tend to just value them at the value of the input rather than the output. So we think an hour of labor gives you an hour of output. And I think, for instance, in education, I mean, one of the big problems is sort of figuring out what is the education production function. We have inputs like teachers and technology, and then what is the output that we get from the educational system? So I think it's you wouldn't really want to just say, well, we put this many hours of teacher in, and we get that many hours of smarter kids out. So there are a number of cases where it's very difficult to figure out exactly what the product is that's being produced by the service labor.
Then maybe economics is incomplete and you need other ways of measuring things.
One thing that's good about economics is it's willing to actually develop incompleteness theorems or non-existence theorems. And I think one of the things here is that there's no perfect way to do any of these things. You have to do them through a political compromise. And anytime we develop an index or a way of measuring things, really any accounting system, there's no perfect way to do it. And people just have to be aware that there are these various compromises involved in any measurement system. So that's where economics is actually better in many ways at telling people you just can't do this perfectly. And don't keep thinking you can. So that's what I like about economics, is it actually comes up with a lot of incompleteness and impossibility theorems to make us aware of the limits on our ability to do these kinds of things.
You're listening to a conversation between feminist economics professor Joyce Jacobson and Wings producer Kellia Ramirez Watson. Here's Kellia.
On October 9, 2013, President Barack Obama named Dr. Janet Yellen as his choice to succeed Ben Bernanke as chair of the Fed. Yellen is professor emerita of the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, and a former head of the San Francisco branch of the Federal Reserve System, which has 12 regional branches. As of this recording with Dr. Joyce Jacobson, Yellen is vice chair of the Fed. The Fed is in charge of monetary policy, such as money supply and the level of key interest rates, including the rate at which banks make overnight loans to each other. The Fed's actions heavily influence the global economy, so a woman who heads the Fed would be one of the most powerful women on Earth. How did you come to be the person who disseminated the letter to President Obama that Janet Yellen should be nominated for chair of the Federal Reserve?
Well, I actually wrote the letter. So my friend Heidi Hartman, who runs the Institute for Women's Policy Research, just happened to contact me in the first week of September and said, you know, she'd been thinking about doing something. She felt that Janet Yellen wasn't being fully represented in her strengths. And did I want to help her with a letter? And I happened to be sitting in Reno right then with my father because he was getting some eye surgery done. And so I said, well, I actually have a little spare time this week because I'm mostly just sitting around making sure he's okay. So why don't I go ahead and do that? So I actually drafted the letter, and then we went through about 12 more drafts before we came up with the final one. But basically, the two of us put together that project and contacted the early signers and then sent it. I probably wrote over 500 other economists that I either know personally or slightly know or knew of to see if they could sign it. We circulated it on these various listservs. And so we basically managed that project.
The data that I found, and I looked very quickly this morning, said 505 male and female economists signed it.
Yeah, I think by the end we had that many. And so it was over the course of about a week. And so I was the one sort of behind the scenes verifying people's identities and formatting the names and so forth. And we put that letter together. And Heidi's in Washington, D.C., so she's kind of got her ear to the ground more and had the contact in the White House to pass along the letter. And so by the end of the weekend already, we had got a lot of answers, and then the press started getting hold of it and so wrote up some stories. And by the middle of the week, we'd kind of gone live with the early version. I think at that point there were about 350 signatures. So it kept changing depending on when the story came out. And then some senators said, well, you know, we're not so sure about this. So I don't think that was complete coincidence. I think our bringing the topic back up got that little last push on the fulcrum to change the direction of where things were going. And then by Sunday, the other main contender, Larry Summers, pulled his name out. And at that point, then, you know, we sort of redoubled our efforts to just make clear that Janet Yellen would be preferred over other potential candidates. And so a month later, on October 9th, she was nominated. So I think we did have an effect there. I mean, that the timing was really critical on that. And we were obviously very lucky to get in right then. But it also had a lot of effect, I think, to have a letter that both had quantity of economists as well as very high quality, particularly the lead signers. So we played both the quantity and quality aspect. And many feminist economists did sign that letter, but so did many other people as well.
So senators were unhappy that you economists were butting in for someone?
Is that- I don't think they were unhappy. I think actually for the Democratic senators that already had some doubts perhaps about Larry Summers as a candidate, this might have provided the final impetus for them to go more public with stating they would not support him. And of course, they had come out during the summer. A number of them had signed a letter indicating they're favoring Yellen as well. But it had sort of died down a bit. And so I think the push that we did at that critical juncture made the difference, potentially.
She's vice chair of the Fed right now. How often does a vice chair become chair?
My understanding is this is the only time that has happened, or will happen, hopefully. Well, it's kind of like vice president. You don't always get to go up to president. But in this case, really, nobody ever had. It wasn't that they couldn't, but it just always was another person came along.
You said that after Larry Summers pulled out, folks who signed the letter made it clear that Yellen was preferable to others. Why?
Well, I think we'd already made clear in the letter why we thought she was an excellent candidate.
According to the letter, Yellen's predictive abilities are among the factors that make her the best candidate. She warned of an impending real estate meltdown in 2005, and in 2007, she warned that difficulties in the financial sector could cause a major recession. The letter also pointed out her nuanced understanding of labor markets, as evidenced in her speeches and scholarly writings.
I think really at this point, other than Ben Bernanke, the person that had the most experience really in dealing with the Federal Reserve System was she, and we weighted that highly in our thinking.
Did you notice any sexism in the assessments of Yellen's qualifications in the media or by people inside Washington?
No, it's always hard to say. People are pretty clever nowadays, and they don't come out and say sexist comments the way they could have said sexist comments 40, 50 years ago. So it's much more hidden now, and often can be just more very subtle signals about questioning people's leadership abilities on things that may or may not be correlated with their gender. And I mean, I think we also played on that in our letter of talking about ability to come to consensus as a positive aspect, which is often viewed as a more feminine ability, but we just view it as a leadership ability that, again, some women have, some men have. So we weren't particularly playing that ourselves, but other people may have read our letter as playing that way, too.
The letter said, quote, Dr. Yellen is willing to hear multiple points of view and to bring many voices into the policymaking arena. She is not beholden to a single interest group nor to a single industry. We believe that Janet Yellen is an extremely effective leader who has demonstrated her capacity to work with the other Federal Reserve Board governors. I read an article that mentioned the gravitas issue. Whenever somebody they're not sure of, they question their gravitas, but he said Bernanke also was questioned on that. He's soft-spoken, he seeks consensus, but it wasn't a problem for him. And it seemed more like the gravitas issue becomes a problem more for women. Do you think that's the case?
Potentially. I mean, it is such a high-level position. I remember when Bernanke was nominated, there were a lot of questions about whether he was going to be the right person for exactly the kind of reasons you speak of. So I think the press is very good these days at always really bringing out the negative as well as the positive on people. I mean, I guess that's the good thing about having an open press. You do get to see people from various sides. And I really think that particularly this debate was very interesting over the last few months because we did learn so much about Janet Yellen in particular in a way that people, you know, normally don't get that caught up in these kinds of topics. And certainly even with the Bernanke, it was more of an insider discussion. It wasn't in the national press as much. And I think that's all to the good that there was a lot of discussion about this, because anytime we do discuss these types of gendered issues in public, I think it's educational for the public to see how they play out as well. And in this case, again, it was kind of a happy ending of how it played out.
Okay, so going back to the issue of closing the gender gap, what would it take? How would Yellen, as chair of the Fed, help that at all?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think you were interested in thinking about whether she was a feminist economist, perhaps, also. And I don't think, she's certainly not a member of the association, but I mean, she is clearly a feminist in many ways and as an economist. And more importantly, I think what we were interested in was her continued commitment to really concern about the continued both high unemployment and just high joblessness. Again, many people who are not even looking for work at this point. Whenever we're in a growth period, my research has shown that periods of economic growth where there's more tightness in the job market are good for getting both women and minorities into positions and more likely to be promoted. So tight job markets tend to help the people that are farther down the ladder get on the ladder and start making progress. In that sense, my feeling is that policies that push for higher levels of job holding are very positive for women and minorities.
Is there any problem from a feminist economics point of view of Yellen?
I don't think there are any. I mean, she's not going to be somebody who's going to be talking about feminist issues necessarily on a day-to-day basis. It doesn't mean, again, monetary policy doesn't have these, as I've just pointed out, could very much have big effects on distribution, for instance. But she is aware of those things, and from her writings, again, is very aware of how labor markets can be inefficient, how it is hard to get them stimulated. And again, has done research where she's perfectly made clear she's aware that there are distributional differences.
And how does having a woman heading the Federal Reserve, what does that say to the world?
Well, I think any time you see somebody that's playing against type, essentially, especially when you have the first of anybody in a position, again, whether it's a minority or a lower class person in an upper class position or a woman in what's viewed as a man's, it's always positive because it helps break down these stereotypes and say that what matters for choosing positions or people to be in positions is things other than these easily observed characteristics about them. And so I think the fact that she doesn't look like your standard central banker, you know, is just really great because it breaks down those stereotypes and says you've got to judge people on their qualifications and on their record and not on these easy to observe characteristics. So anytime we have a case where it plays against type like this, I just think it's great. And anytime we've opened up all positions to say it, at some point in time, different kinds of people have been in them, that's all for the better too. It breaks down the kinds of segregation we still see operating so heavily in our labor market.
You've been listening to Dr. Joyce Jacobson, Andrews Professor of Economics at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. The website for the International Association for Feminist Economics is www.iaffe.org. That's www.iaffe.org. Although the email listserv is packed with PhD-level economists, the International Association for Feminist Economics welcomes anyone interested in feminist viewpoints on questions of economic analysis, policy, and practice. For Wings, I'm Kellia Ramirez Watson in Berkeley, California.
To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. And please check our daily women's news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.